It is wonderful to see everyone. It is wonderful to be able to connect once again in anticipation of the embrace of Kabbalah Satorah over the course of Shavuos by convening together to learn together and to grow together and to connect to some of the more fundamental elements of Yahadus as we approach the experience of Kabbalah Satorah. We are in the course of discussing issues related to Yerushalayim. And we know that this week, Mirtz Hashem, we're going to celebrate Yom Yerushalayim. We're going to celebrate the reunification of the city of Yerushalayim in the Milchama of 1967. And many of us in this shir, myself included, have certainly no data point of life experience to even conjure in our imagination what it would be like to encounter an experience of being in the land of Israel without being able to come close to the Makom HaMikdash, to the Kotel, to the experience of being connected to Yerushalayim. And so for many of us, it's certainly something that we take for granted, and therefore perhaps each year, as we come upon this season, as we come upon the season related to Yom Yerushalayim, it's important to take a step back and to reinvigorate our appreciation for and our connection to these very fundamental elements of Yahadus, of our religious life, and of our religious experience. So tonight, we're going to talk about the Kotel. We're going to talk about the Kotel, which all of us miss dearly. We have definitely seen the pictures as they have set up the Kotel in anticipation of hosting Minyanim in this new reality, which looks very, very different than the way we've seen it before. I think many of us even would go so far as to say we miss being approached for money at the Kotel. That's how badly we miss the Kotel. I learned very quickly in my trips to Eretz Yisrael that wearing a tie costs you an enormous amount of money at the Kotel. They get it really quick that you're from America. Anyway, so here we are celebrating Yom Yerushalayim, and here we are reflecting on the Kotel. The question is, what really is the uniqueness of the Kotel? We, of course, know it relates to the Beis HaMikdash. Why is it that it pulsates in our religious consciousness and our national identity with such strong power of emotion, power of significance, power of spirituality? What really is it all about? And that's what we're going to discuss this evening. So our journey begins with the Medrash in Eicha that talks about Titus, who came upon the Jewish people and, of course, was responsible for the conquest of Yerushalayim during the days of Churban Beis HaMikdash. And we know in the course of the Jewish calendar, we devote an enormous amount of time to mourning the Beis HaMikdash, the Bein HaMetzorim, 3 weeks, all leading with increasing intensity towards the commemoration of Tisha B'Av, where we sit in mourning for our Churban HaBayis. Sitting on Tisha B'Av, we recall the destruction itself, and the Medrash tells us that Titus essentially assigned each general a different sector of the city to conquer and to destroy. And each one was able to fulfill their mission except for the one who was given the western side of the mountain. He comes to Titus and says to Titus, we're not able to destroy this wall. In Titus's frustration that the general is unable to fulfill his mission, his requirements, the general explains to Titus, no, this is going to stand as a testament to you, Titus, to your identity and impact as a conqueror of the Jewish people. If we raise the building entirely and we essentially eradicate all vestige of presence of the building at all, then no one will know in perpetuity that it was really the mighty Titus that came to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Instead, we leave one wall standing, and with that wall, the Jewish people will always look longingly at the void that exists in this space, and they will remember the enemies of the Jewish people that brought about this reality, playing to Titus's vanity and arrogance, trying to justify and validate his inability to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. And of course, we know that we have a little bit of a different narrative at what essentially was responsible for that barrier and inability to bring the Beis HaMikdash to its entire destruction. The Medrash tells us in source number 2, Hine ze omed achar kosleinu ze kosel amaravi, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu stands, as the Pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, beyond the wall. Hashem stands beyond the wall. Ze kosel maravi shel Beis HaMikdash. This is the western wall of the Beis HaMikdash. She'eino charav la'olam. That is never destroyed. Lama, why is it never destroyed? Shashchina b'marav. Because there is an accentuated presence of Shechina in the western part of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore it is not susceptible to the destruction of our enemies. We know from Chazal that ultimately it's not Titus that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. It's the Jewish people that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash stood as an edifice that was able to contain the supernatural and transcendent presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's impossible that an enemy of the Jewish people would be able to penetrate such a fortress of Kedusha and Tara and spirituality. The only way that was possible is because Am Yisrael expelled from the world of the Mikdash the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because we created an environment and a reality that was so incongruous with hosting the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence could not continue to be manifest, rendering the area simply a building and susceptible to the destruction of our enemies. And therefore Titus comes and destroys the Beis HaMikdash, everything except for that western wall. So what's fascinating is in the Midrashim, the Kotel really lives with two identities. One identity the Kotel lives with is it stands as a testament to Churban, to destruction, to what's missing, to what's not there, to the incomplete sense of presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu within Klal Yisrael. The fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not fully on that mountain and doesn't reside in all of his manifest glory within the Jewish people. It stands as a testament to Churban. At the same time, the Midrashim speak that the Kotel HaMaravi is not just a symbol of destruction, but also something that embodies a sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence himself. It also embodies the promise and the guarantee that there is a constant nitzchios of Klal Yisrael, that the Jewish people are eternal, that God's presence can never be fully expelled from anywhere, and that no matter what the Jewish people do and how we comport ourselves, there's always some dimension and some element of presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam there on Har HaBayis. And that is a reflection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for the Jewish people, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's enduring commitment to the Jewish people. And the Midrashim go on, if you look at source number 3, Hine ze omed achar kosleinu kosel maravi shel Beis HaMikdash, lama shenishpalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu she'eino charev la'olam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised that this wall will never, ever, ever be destroyed. So the Kotel embodies the eternality of the Jewish people and our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It could never be severed, as the Medrash says again in Shmos Rabbah. This duality that emerges from these Midrashim reflects itself in our own experience, because when we go to the Kotel, we also have somewhat of a paradoxical experience. On one hand, we walk down those stairs and we walk up to the plaza and we see this wall, and we see what's also on Har HaBayis today, and we are struck with a certain sense of sadness and void, and the notion that the Jewish people live unredeemed, that we don't have a full expression of what it means to live with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our midst. And what do? We tear kriya. We rip our clothing, unless you go on a particular day, or you sell and exchange. There's a lot of things that people do to try to avoid this. But we tear kriya. When we used to take trips of teenagers from NCSY to Israel, and we would take them there for the first time. So we used to have all of them wear blindfolds at the top of the plaza. We used to walk them down. They would put their arms on each other. They would all line up in front. They would remove it all at the same time. And they would be awestruck by this wall of spirituality and this wall of identity and connection. The Kotel doesn't just symbolize loss and destruction and mourning. We also connect there in a very positive disposition as well. We celebrate there. We make bar mitzvahs there. We put on tefillin for the first time there. We have all sorts of ceremonies there, inducting soldiers into Tzva Hagana Yisrael. A couple of years ago, when I had the great opportunity to attend the opening of the United States Embassy in Yerushalayim, it was on the day after Yom Yerushalayim. So I was at the Kotel for Yom Yerushalayim. Hundreds of thousands of people, music and celebrating and dancing and singing. And so these two different sentiments of Jewish history collide right there at that spot within the hearts of every Jew that encounters that space and within the Jewish people at large as we connect to the Makom HaMikdash, to the Kotel HaMaravi. On one hand, we live the Medrash Eicha, the Medrash that recognizes that this is a symbol of what we don't have, of what we're lacking, of what we're missing. On the other hand, we also live the Medrash of Shir HaShirim. We also have a certain sense of connection that is cultivated and nurtured standing at the Kotel HaMaravi. And so really, it's part of both. And the Kli Yakar in source number 5 shares so beautifully when he talks about B'chol HaMistakel B'Makom HaMikdash. Anybody who has the opportunity to look at the Makom HaMikdash. Hahu miyan nislabish ruach tahara v'kedusha v'melech elyum, that they are overcome and overwhelmed by a certain sense of spirit, a certain sense of connection, a certain sense of presence of the Ribbon Shalom. And he goes on to say that the fact that the, like we spoke about last week, the fact that this spot is referred to in Sefer Bereishis with the word yir'en, yira'eh, with the word to see and to be seen, that Yerushalayim, that the Makom HaMikdash actually embodies both of those perspectives. It's a place where you can see HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a place where you can be uplifted and inspired and feel a transcendent sense of connection. You could see a little bit more of the Ribbono Shel Olam, but it's also a place where you can be seen. It is a place where you become, where you surrender to the history and legacy of the Jewish people, where you become absorbed in its stones and in its crevices, where you give yourself to the reality of what it represents, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always, 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 even when there is destruction and foreign nations all around us, always, always, there's that one anchor of confidence that the Ribbono Shel Olam remains connected to the Jewish people. And I share with you in source number 6 some of the autobiographical accounts of the soldiers who conquered the wall itself. And you can see in the sentiments that they express this duality, these two emotions. Moshe Amirov, who's now a professor, or at least was a professor of political science at Hebrew University, he was a paratrooper. It's with a smile that I remember how he looked for the wall. We ran there, a group of panting soldiers lost on the plaza of the Temple Mount, searching for a giant stone wall. We didn't stop to look at the mosque, even though this was the first time we had seen it close up. Forward, forward, hurriedly we pushed our way through the gates, and we suddenly stopped, thunderstruck. There it was before our eyes, gray and massive, silent and restrained, the Western Wall. I remember that I had such a feeling only once before in my life. It had been when I was a child and my father brought me near to the Holy Ark in the synagogue. As a little infant, I'd been afraid that something would come out of the Ark, something big and terrible from another world. But slowly and slowly I began to approach the wall, in fear and trembling like a pious cantor going to the lectern to lead the prayers. I approached it as a messenger of my father and my grandfather, of my great-grandfather, and all the generations and all of the exiles who had never merited to see it, that they had sent me to represent them. And someone made the bracha of Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'giyanu bazman hazeh, but I couldn't answer amen. I just put my hand on the stone and the tears started to flow. And the tears were not my tears, they were the tears of all of Israel, tears of hope and of prayer, tears of Hasidic tunes, tears of Jewish dances, tears which scorched and burned into the heavy gray stone. And we see the sentiments, we see these emotions, we see the power of connection that emanates from the Kotel HaMaravi, and you're welcome to read the next one as well. It comes from Avraham Duvdevani, who was also the chair of the WCO, who also expresses if you know what it was like to kiss the stones for the very first time. If you look at the second paragraph, past, present, and future, all in one kiss, there will be no more destruction and the wall will never again be deserted. It was taken with young Jewish blood, and the worth of that blood is eternity. The blood is coupled to the rows of the stones. The face is pushed into the spaces between them, and the hands try to reach its heart. So there's this beautiful, beautiful expression of, on one hand, it's a moment of destruction and tragedy of all the blood that's been spilled, of everyone who's been lost. On the other hand, it's such a sense of triumph, of connection for the Jewish people. So this is the Kotel HaMaravi. And the question we have to address is, what exactly is it that this wall stands as? What is the nature of this wall? What are we actually looking at when we look at this wall? What is it the wall of? So this is actually an extensive discussion. Most of us who've been on tours of the Old City or of Israel, or have just been generally educated to understand that this is the wall of the Temple Mount. So that is not a consensus position in the world of halacha. The Ritbaz, which is a very important source with regards to the whole discussion of Har HaBayis, because the Ritbaz is one of the very explicit sources that places the stone that is under the mosque on the Har HaBayis as the Eben Shesia, which has implications for how we topographically map out the rest of the Beis HaMikdash to figure out where we can and where we cannot go on that Har HaBayis. But in the course of that discussion, he makes an assertion that's a little surprising. He writes, if you look at the second column in source number 7, he writes about 5 or 6 lines from the bottom, Mikol Makom, Lamanu ki akotel ahu be'atzmo hu kotel ha'azara. That the kotel was not the wall of Har HaBayis. The kotel was the wall of the actual temple court itself, of the Beis HaMikdash itself. This would pose a significant halachic challenge. And the reason for that is because, we're not going to get too off course into this topic, but it's important to understand that the areas, the concentric circles of Yerushalayim, have an increasing intensity of restriction as you get closer and closer to the focal point of Yerushalayim and the world, and that is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Yerushalayim itself is restricted to certain types of impurities. The Har HaBayis is restricted to other types of impurities, and the Beis HaMikdash is restricted to even more types of impurities. People who are Tamei Meis, who've come into contact with a dead body, and we presume that all of us have at some point come into contact with a dead body on some level, and so therefore we are all considered Tamei Meis. People who are Tamei Meis may not go into the area of the Har HaBayis upon which the Beis HaMikdash stood. They are not allowed to go into that area. There's a chiyuv kares to go into that area. But someone who is Tamei Meis may go into the area of Har HaBayis. That's not where the Beis HaMikdash stood, except for a certain buffer zone called the Chil, which was which essentially surrounds the Beis HaMikdash, where there's a prohibition to go there as well. But to be on the Har HaBayis as a Tamei Meis is still problematic if you also have other types of tumos that are yotze migufo, tumos that are basically bodily emissions that result in tumah. If that's the case, you're not allowed onto the Har HaBayis at all without going to the mikvah. Those are tumos that we can get rid of today. We cannot eradicate tumas meis today. We need a para aduma. But we can become purified from other tumos and theoretically go on to the Har HaBayis. A lot of controversy about how that would work practically, because first of all, we'd have to know exactly where these boundaries are. And there is archaeological conflict and other types of conflict in figuring that out. And second of all, there are other considerations of going on Har HaBayis and motivations and why we're doing it. And so that's its own controversial topic. I leave that to other shurim on YU Torah for them to get in trouble. But everybody agrees that you can't just walk on to the Har HaBayis if you are in a state of tumah. If the Kotel HaMaravi is the wall of the Beis HaMikdash, then standing in the plaza of the Kotel HaMaravi may place you on the Har HaBayis, or it may place you very close to the Azara. That could create significant challenges. There are other sources that also confirm this theory. Chachmas Adam confirms it. And then there are other sources that want to not necessarily embrace this theory, but want to account for it in the halachic process, and therefore are very machmir. Will not, there are people who will not go right up to the wall. They'll stay a little further from the wall because they don't want to take any chances that maybe they're on the harabayis. The Kaftor of Aferach in source number 11, the Avnei Nezer in source number 12, the Ir HaKodesh, well, HaMikdosh, Rechiel Michal Tukachinsky in source number 13, all embrace the position, which is also considered from an archaeological perspective to be correct, that the wall of the Kotel Hamaravi was a retaining wall of the Harabayis. That means that if it's a retaining wall of the Harabayis, if you're on the other side of the Kotel, Kotel's the western wall, so when you're facing it, you're facing the western wall, you're basically facing east. So that wall itself may be holding up the Harabayis, but beyond it, where you are in the plaza, that wouldn't be considered such a problem. And it's Eliezer writes in source number 14, "Benokei l'kotel ha'maravi kvar nimnu v'gomru she'inenu mikotel ha'azara kim kotel harabayis." He takes the position that it's already assumed that it is not the kotel of the Azara, it's the kotel of the Harabayis. And so therefore, you only begin to encounter the various halachic and political considerations if you climb that ramp and you enter into the place of the Harabayis itself, but standing at the plaza, the kotel shouldn't be a problem. So should it be a problem or shouldn't it be a problem? The next question is, if the wall of the kotel is the wall of the Harabayis, what about not approaching the wall of the Kotel, but what about touching it or putting your fingers into it? I think many of us have deep tactile memory of the smooth stones, the smooth cold stones of the Kotel. Or people give us notes to put into the Kotel. Can we put our fingers into the Kotel, or is moving inside the wall already considered being inside the Harabayis? So our presumption in this discussion is based on the Rambam. The Rambam assumes that there is Kedusha on the Harabayis Bizman Hazeh. The Ravid disagrees, but many interpret that Ravid to mean that there is Kedusha, just not a Chiyuv Kares. And the Rambam writes that if anybody walks into an area that has Kedusha, that's a very serious Isser, that's potentially a Chiyuv Kares. But what if you don't put your whole body into the area, you just put some of your body into the area? You do a spiritual hokey-pokey. You put your right hand in, or your left hand in, right? What if you're just, you're not putting your whole self in. You're just a little bit of yourself in to the Harabayis. Is that a problem? So the Gemara in Zvachim discusses this, and the Gemara comes to the conclusion that Bia B'miktsas, coming a little bit onto the Harabayis, a little tease, sticking your hand into the Harabayis and pulling it out, that also is an Isser. That also is significant. And the Rambam holds that that's an Isser D'Rabbanan. The Ravid might hold that that's even an Isser D'Oraisa. And so therefore, we need to be concerned that if we stick our hands inside the Kotel, maybe we're a little bit on Harabayis. And therefore, we would have a significant halachic problem. However, other opinions, and there are opinions that are concerned for this, and therefore, there are definitely those that you will encounter who will not touch or put their fingers in the Kotel at all, for this reason. I apologize. For this reason. There are those that won't put notes inside, they won't touch it, they won't put their fingers in, because they are concerned that that might be Bia B'miktsas, might be putting your hands a little bit into it. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach has an interesting chiddush where he writes, the only time we're going in a little bit is a problem halachically, is if in theory you could go in entirely. So, if you were to walk up that ramp, and they were to open the gate, let's assume that after that ramp is Harabayis, halachically, which is questionable. So, if you stuck your hand in, you put your right hand in, and you shook it all about, so that would be a problem, says Rav Shlomo Zalman. That's Bia B'miktsas. That's an Isser. However, if you put your hand in, that's because, in theory, you could put your whole self in. It's just you're putting your hand in. So therefore, we don't want you to put a part of your body in. That could lead to putting your whole body in. But if you're putting your part of your body in an area that could never have your entire body, most of us cannot fit inside a crack of the kotel, even a big one, certainly after 3 months of quarantine, none of us could fit in any crack of the kotel, in any configuration whatsoever. So therefore, putting our hand in a little bit is a bia b'miktsas that's not going to lead to anything else, and therefore would be considered acceptable. There are other fascinating tshuvos related to the Kedusha of the Kotel. Rav Moshe has a famous tshuva that discusses, he was asked by someone if it is permissible to, you get to the Kotel and you decide, you know, I'd love the ultimate souvenir. So I'll take a little piece of the stone off the Kotel and I'll take it back with me. I remember that when I took a group of students from Yeshiva University to Germany on a trip to see the Jews of Germany, we spent Shabbos in Leipzig. So I came home and I showed my wife that I bought a piece of the Berlin Wall. I was a kid when the Berlin Wall fell, and I bought a piece of the Berlin Wall. She looks at me and she's like, where'd you get this? I said, I got it at the airport. It's a piece of the Berlin Wall. She says, this is not a piece of the Berlin Wall. This is a piece of the parking lot of the airport. This is not, you don't have the Berlin Wall. I'm like, that's not true. So this, I moved it out of my house. It sits in my office at YU, where it's more appreciated. And it sits, stands, it's got the spray paint on it and everything. So this guy decides he wants a piece of the Kotel. So Rav Moshe explains that it's not just a wall. It's a wall that's consecrated to serve as part of the Harabayas, as part of the Makom HaMikdash. There's Kedusha in that wall. You're not allowed to destroy any part of that wall. And then Rav Moshe writes, and this is just a fascinating comment, and you're welcome to explore it on your own later, in source number 24, it's just an interesting, from the halachic process standpoint, Rav Moshe writes on the second page of the Tshuva, he writes about four lines down, af below in yonei ha-isser, even without the question of an isser, v'chiyu rak ish echad ba'olam, are you the only person in the whole world? Everybody wants a piece of the Kotel. People would pay a lot of money. So what's going to happen? Everybody's going to take a piece. There'll be no more Kotel. Rav Moshe, he's saying to him, you want me to quote Yosef and Shulchan Aruch why it's wrong? But from a common sense perspective, what a selfish thing to do. So what do we see? We see that there's this notion that there's Kedusha in the stones. The Kedusha emanates from its role and its space in supporting that Harabayis. There are tshuvas that the poskim discuss when retrofitting needs to be done. If you don't know what retrofitting, I grew up in California, so we learned the word retrofit in nursery. But basically it means to ensure that things that are precarious don't fall. So when you're retrofitting, they need to sometimes, from an engineering standpoint, be sure of the stability of the wall. Sometimes they have to work with the wall. So the post can write, that's not considered destructive. That's constructive. You're trying to do what's right. But the notion is that the Kotel stands as a Makom Kadosh, and there's Kedusha in the wall itself. You're not allowed to destroy the wall. The wall contains and it has all of this sense of meaning and all of this sense of connection. There's a beautiful tshuva from the Yaskil Avdi, where he was asked if a person, when they arrive at the Kotel after the Six-Day War for the first time, should they make a Shechiyanu? And he actually argues, in this case, that when they got to the Kotel in Milchemes Sheshes Hayamim, he argues that one should not make a Shechiyanu. There are others that believe, I quoted here in source number 26, Rav Fogelman, that he believes that one should. But he believes that you shouldn't. And it's interesting what his reasoning is in source 25. His first reason is, we make Shechiyanus on Dover Mizman Lizman. We make Shechiyanus, Shechiyanu v'kiyimanu v'giyanu lazman hazeh. Or, if you grew up in the house of the Chazan, lazman hazeh, right? So you got to have this man hazeh. And this is not Mizman Lizman. So, and then he says, even if it is Mizman Lizman, listen to this, about five lines down in source number 25. Maybe you can just generate the bracha of Shechiyanu by the sheer force of your sense of Simchas Halev, your heartfelt sense of Simcha. That's only if your Simcha is complete, it's total. We don't have total simcha. Because we can't go up there and build the Beis HaMikdash. The opposite is true. In In fact, b'chol zman shanu ochlim holchim l'kotel ha-maravi, every time we go to the Kotel ha-maravi, we roll in Mokum Amigdash and we see the Mokum Amigdash. We can't go there. Yesh lanu. We have this certain sense of tsar al shadayin chorav beis mikdashenu v'shualim holchubo. We see foxes. We see the destruction. We see the devastation. So you're going to show up at the Kotel ha-maravi and you're so excited because you took your trip from El Al and you took your Sheirut and you checked in at the plaza and you got to be Mahadrin and then you get the cab and you get there and he tells you it's 80 shekel and everybody pays 80 shekel and there's traffic so it's really 120 shekel but he's giving you a deal and then you get out and you make your way down to the Kotel and you're so excited. You want to say Shechiyonu v'kiyamanu v'kiyonu v'azman hazeh. That's appropriate. You're looking at a churban of the Beis HaMikdash. He says you can't say Shechiyanu. And his third reason why he says you can't say Shechiyanu is because he brings an interesting precedent. We don't make a Shechiyanu on Hanochas Tefillin and Ksiva Sefer Torah because it required Shechitas Behemos, Ubale Chaim. And we don't make brachas on things that require destruction in order to achieve them. He said, let's not forget that we have the Kotel at a cost. You know, the euphoria that surrounds the victory of the Six-Day War sometimes overshadows the casualties that were very much part of that experience. And we forget sometimes that we paid a tremendous price for this privilege. And we continue to pay a tremendous price for this privilege to be able to connect with the Ribbono Shel Olam in such a holy and sanctified state. Space. So to show up there and say Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'kiyanu l'zman hazeh when you know that blood was spilled in order for us to achieve this goal, he said that's inappropriate. Other posts can disagree, but you see that within these different approaches, you can sense this sense of connection of past and future. I want to end with two points. One from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in Source 29. Beautiful point from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter that I believe I heard from Rav Shai Schechter. And that is, he says, the Pasuk says, Hineze omed achar kosleinu, Shem is beyond the kosel, on the wall, mashkiach mina chalonos, meitzitz mina chorachim, which means God sees from the windows and he peeks through the slats, right? So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says so beautifully, why do you need both of these expressions? What's with all the window treatments, right? Why do you need both of these things? So he says, the Zman at the Beis HaMikdash was Kayam. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu and us, we saw each other through a window. He saw us, we saw him. The presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam was palpable, was felt. We understood there was a God, he was running the world. Even though we didn't understand everything going on, it wasn't a challenge to stay anchored to that reality. After the world of the Churban, we're Meitzitz Min HaCharachim. What does it mean to look through slats? It means that from one side, you see everything completely. And from the other side, you see almost nothing, right? So he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he could still see us. He sees everything going on. He's still there. He's still taking care of us. But to us, what do we see? We see a wall. We see a barrier. We see a separation. We can't always see him. That's what it means to live in the world of Golos. We can't see HaKadosh Baruch Hu easily in all of these circumstances and challenges. But don't be confused. Hashem sees us. It's not a window, but it's not a solid wall. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees us. There's still HaKadosh Baruch Hu still being meitzitz min hacharachim. He still sees us from the other side. And that's the Kotel in our generation. On one hand, it's a wall, it's a barrier. It's something that symbolizes destruction and void in the Jewish people. On the other hand, with a deep, deep price that was paid, it also symbolizes our triumph, our sense of connection, and never losing that that embrace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I want to end, I know we're a few minutes over, so I want to end with my absolute favorite story from Rabbi Lau's book, Out of the Depths, where he talks about his brother Naftali. His brother Naftali, who recalled his last conversation with his father, in which his father accounted, this is in Source 30, 37 generations of rabbis. This is Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau's brother. 37 generations of rabbis on both his and his mother's side of the family, and he did this to demonstrate the great responsibility of whoever would be saved from the horror of the Holocaust to continue the chain of our heritage. And then he read from a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, "There is hope for your future. The word of God and your children will return home." V'shavu banim ligvulam. He said this before anywhere near the possibility of a state of Israel. He emphasized that if we escape this inferno safely, we would know how to find our home. We would know how to find our home, which was not this home or any other on this enemy land. Your home will be in Eretz Yisrael, even if you have to acquire it through suffering, he said. And Naftali and father cried on each other's necks, and after embracing each other tightly, Naftali returned to his job in the ghetto. Father's words echoed in his ears. Father believed that I, the youngest son of the Lau family, Rav Yisrael Meir, would escape the inferno safely and pass along the heritage that the Nazis were attempting to destroy. For 50 years, I carried the responsibility passed on to me by my father. This is Naftali talking in the book that he wrote called Bilam's Prophecy. Before he went to his death in Treblinka, he placed in my care a weak child who was 5 years old, but looked like he was only 3 or younger. And for 3 years I served as father and mother and guardian and protector to my younger brother, Yisrael Meir. I often felt despair attacking me, flinging me helplessly to my destruction. I think it was the mission my father gave me to bring my younger brother to safety and to ensure the continuation of our family's rabbinic dynasty that kept me alive and gave me the will to continue fighting for our lives, rather than succumb to the horrible fate that befell the rest of the family. On the first day of the Hebrew month of Adar, February 21st, 1993, I stood with my younger brother in front of the Western Wall in Jerusalem, the holiest site in the world for Jews, and we recited the afternoon prayer together. 48 years earlier, when we first arrived in Jerusalem, we stood in this same spot. Then young Yisrael Meir had gazed at the stones of the wall without understanding what he was seeing. This time he was praying just 2 hours before he anticipated his anticipated election to the highest rabbinical post in Israel. My younger brother, who had risen from the pile of ashes in the death camps, was chosen that day to serve as the chief rabbi of the state of Israel. I looked at him from up close and felt tears welling up in my eyes. As I left the wall, I felt profound relief, as if a heavy burden had been lifted from my shoulders and my conscience. At last, my almost impossible mission had been fulfilled. And that's our beloved Kotel, our bridge from the past to the future, from tragedy to hope, from destruction to ultimate redemption. Everyone should have a wonderful Yom Yerushalayim.